And our last case for oral argument this morning is A18-1849, Shea Foss, appellant versus Justine Topol, respondent. Good morning, counsel. While you are all setting up, you each have 15 minutes for argument, each side. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. And counsel for appellant, take your time getting ready and adjusting the podium, and et cetera. And then whenever you are ready, just state your name and the party you represent for the record.
May it please the court, my name is Glenn Bruder. I represent the appellant in this proceeding, Shane Foss. The broad issue before the court this morning in this case is whether the district court erred by denying appellant retroactive modification of his child care support obligation. The appellant and the respondent are the parents of two children born in 2007 and 2009. Following the conclusion of the party's relationship, the respondent adopted a third child who was born in 2012. There's a lengthy, rather convoluted history to this case, and thankfully I'm not going to go through it this morning, but I do want to highlight a couple things for the court. In 2011, the appellant was ordered to pay $800 a month in child care support, together with a host of other support obligations. At the time, respondent claimed that she had nearly $2,000 per month in child care expenses. In 2018, approximately 6 or 7 years later, the appellant brought a motion to modify his child care support obligation. He alleged that he'd been substantially overpaying for a lengthy period of time, and in his April 12, 2018 affidavit, the appellant noted that respondent's tax returns listed her annual child care expense obligation and that those expenses averaged $356 for all three children in 2016 and $217 a month for all three children in 2017. So this was not a small amount of overpayment, but several hundred dollars each month. The parties agreed in 2018 that moving forward, they would divide the actual child care expenses for their two children using the PICS formula. So moving forward, the issue is settled. The issue left for resolution by the court at that time was what would happen with the past overpayments. The appellants...
And when do you allege that the overpayments of child care began?
That is unclear from the record that's in front of us at this time. The respondent did not provide copies of her 2013 and 2014 tax returns, as I recall. There's a chart actually in Mr. Foss's April 2018 affidavit, and those years are a blank slate, so to speak. 2012, she did provide a copy of her return, and it looks like her child care expenses were approximately as represented in the 2011 order at that time.
And that was just under $2,000.
Correct. But by 2016 and 2017, it was clear that they had declined dramatically. So I can't point to a specific date right now, but I can certainly say that the record is very clear that in the 2 years preceding the filing of this motion, every month Mr. Foss was overpaying by several hundred dollars per month.
Mr. Bruder, if you would, I mean, listening to what you say kind of makes me think, look, I could understand, and I would believe it's not an abuse of discretion for the judge here to apply this change retroactively, at least for a few years. So I could understand if the judge did that, but I also don't understand why it's an abuse of discretion not to do that, because that's the standard, isn't it?
The standard on retroactive modification
right.
is an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, and this court has and I believe it's the Brodsky decision, which is noted at page 15 of my brief, indicated that when a judge fails to correctly apply the law, that is an abuse of discretion. The statute, 518.39 subdivision 7, specifically says that child care support must be based on actual child care expenses. It then gives the judge some discretion as to whether or not the facts warrant giving a retroactive modification here.
But surely the appellant isn't arguing that must really means must, because in this case the party stipulated that he would not pay the full amount of child care expense.
Your Honor, I think that the statutory phrase must does mean must. The parties agreed to something that apparently differs from the statute. But here we get into the convoluted history. The $2,000 a month child care expense was apparently based on a daycare program offered at Medtronic, the respondent's place of employment.
I thought it was Honeywell.
No, my client works at Honeywell, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. But
my understanding further is that the record would reflect that the children were never actually enrolled in that daycare program. And there was some dispute about whether or not in 2011 whether that expense was reasonable or not. The parties just decided to settle their differences and peg $800 a month as the child care support amount. So I guess it would be my position that what the parties did is by agreement did something that the statute doesn't necessarily permit.
Let's just be clear about that, though. The parties may have agreed to it, but then that was incorporated into a court order and a judgment decree, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and your client didn't appeal from that. The time for that is long gone. So it just seems to me what you're trying to do is kind of like attack that original court. But it was a court order here, and that I think would
be inappropriate. No, not at all, Your Honor. That was their agreement. I'm not trying to
attack that. And it was a court order.
Pardon me?
And it was adopted into the judgment decree.
Correct. I'm not trying to attack that at all. I'm trying to explain what happened. But in terms of what I am attacking, it is the district court's decision to not provide the appellant with a retroactive modification when the scope and degree of the overpayment was astronomically high, as it was in this case.
Well, what about the district? One of the reasons the district court said that it wasn't applying this retroactively in its discretion was because of your client's failure to delay in bringing the motion. I mean, why isn't that an appropriate use of the court's discretion? I mean, certainly your client, I think, is involved in these children's lives and knew that they were at ages where they wouldn't need as much daycare as they would have, you know, 6 years before, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Foss's April 2018 affidavit, which is all we have because he wasn't allowed to testify, but indicates that he did, first of all, try to approach the respondent, got no cooperation in terms of providing any information about her actual daycare expense at that time. He then approached the child care worker, since it was automatic wage withholding, who contacted the respondent, and she told him, I still have child care expenses. There's no basis for a modification. So, in essence, the respondent here is the gatekeeper. Child support needs to be based
on... Did your client have no right to child care records directly from the child care provider?
He would not, Your Honor. I mean, that's mentioned in the brief from the respondent, but she's conflating a couple of different notions. One of them is there's a statute that says that if you have legal custody, you're entitled to a variety of materials. It doesn't include private contracts or information relating to private contracts. In a daycare setting, that's not what happens.
So there wouldn't be your client had no right to know what the charges were at that daycare provider?
Correct. The daycare provider would have been within its rights in refusing to provide him with that information because their contract was not with him, it was with the respondent. And frankly, on a practice matter, on a regular basis, I see situations where my clients are trying to get access to the daycare expense information and are refused by the daycare provider, who has been specifically instructed by the person who contracted with them, the custodial parent, not to release that information. Now, granted, I don't think it goes that far in this case. I don't want to overstate the case. But Mr. Foss would have had no legal basis for getting that information without actually starting this kind of a modification motion. I also wanted to touch briefly on something that I think is very clear here. I became involved in this proceeding after the child support magistrate had made her decision. I prepared the notice of review and sought review by a district court judge. That review was to be a de novo review. That's what the rule provides for. The rule says it's an independent review. And a host of decisions of this court say that means it's a de novo review. And Blonigan in particular says the district court judge is not bound by anything that the child support magistrate has done. It's a completely new review. The magistrate is entitled to no deference at all, and the district court judge takes a fresh look at all of this. That's not the standard that was applied in this case by the district court judge.
So if I could just interrupt you there, when I look at this district court order, I mean, it certainly contains the language you refer to, kind of the not supported by the record or contrary to law, but the sentence before that talks about that independent review of the order, you know, that you just referenced. So, you know, at best, they seem to be inconsistent, perhaps, but not like they have arguably the wrong standard and the right standard, correct?
Well, you cited the reference that the judge made to the correct standard, yes, but then the very next sentence at paragraph 4 in order.
I think I was referencing that as well. I'm saying that there is the right standard and the wrong standard both in the same order, correct?
I think that's essentially correct, Your Honor. My concern is that the wrong standard, the district court judge shall affirm the order unless the court determines that the findings are not supported by the record and the decision is contrary to law. That is the language that this state's appellate courts use when they're using an abuse of discretion standard, and that creates a huge problem in this case because it is clearly not the standard that this court contemplated. So the matter gets, I think, clearer in terms of what happens after that. I had exactly the analysis that you just made. I looked at two conflicting statements, and so I filed for the first time in about 10 years a request for reconsideration of a district court order. I essentially wanted to give the district court judge a chance to say either he applied a de novo review or he didn't, so that I would know, frankly, what issues to raise before this court, because it looked pretty clear at that point that this was going to be appealed. And in denying his request for reconsideration, the district court judge issued an order. Paragraph 4 of that order used this sentence: if the court determines that the findings and order are not supported by the record, he indicated that modification of the child support magistrate's order would be appropriate. And then he continues, if the court determines that the findings and order are not supported by the record or the decision is contrary to law, he just recited the same abuse of discretion standard, which seems to be what he applied. And it appears that either the district court judge didn't believe me when I told him that this court suggested it had to be a de novo review, or he understood de novo review in a fashion that was far different than this court has articulated. And frankly, for that basis alone, This case should be remanded with instructions for the district court judge to actually do what is contemplated in a de novo review and to look at all of the issues that have been raised in this matter, including the district, including the child support magistrate's refusal to hear testimony, to flesh out the record, whether there needs to be more testimony, whether the facts are sufficient to show that there was some deliberate misrepresentations on the part of respondent as to her daycare expenses, or whether the magistrate should have heard that testimony. All of those things were encompassed in the idea of a motion for review, and none of them were allowed because of the manner in which the district court judge exercised that authority.
And what testimony was your client going to give that was not permitted? And was there an offer of proof of that?
There was no offer of proof. And that's a difficult question for me to answer because I wasn't his attorney at that hearing, and I don't know what questions the what questions his attorney at that time would have asked him. I can tell you I would have asked him questions about his efforts to discover what the actual child support expenses were, what he had seen from reviewing her tax returns, and whether it appeared that this could have been any kind of an inadvertent oversight. And I probably, well, I may have subpoenaed the child support worker. I don't know if I would have or not for that hearing. And engaging in hindsight and third-party commentary, my time's up. Thank you.
You'll have time for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Just a little bit higher.
Sure.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Ruta Johnson of Nancy Zaleski-Berg Family Law, and I represent respondent, Mother Justine Tabel, in this appeal. Mother is respectfully requesting this court to affirm district court's decision denying father's motion for retroactive modification of child care support dating back all the way to 2011. This is an 8-year-old issue. In 2011, these parties were involved in a paternity dispute that resulted in negotiations, and the parties reached a fully stipulated agreement with regards to all child-related issues, child-related financial issues being one of them, and this encompassed child care support. Now, the child care support statute does say that typically child care support is based on actual expenses and may be retroactively modified to the date of decrease. Minnesota Statute 518A 40 Subdivision 1 also says unless a different agreement is reached between the parties, child care support shall be calculated pursuant to PICS. So back in 2011, the parties knew that the child care expenses incurred by mother were almost $2,000. This number didn't come out of thin air, Your Honors. There was a child support matter that had started prior to this paternity action that caused some issues later with regards to errors. That's not part of this appeal. But looking back in the child support orders, there are findings by the court that clearly state that these expenses were verified. This was not just mother alleging that those were her expenses and everybody accepting them as true.
Well, your client doesn't deny that father attempted informally before this action was commenced to find out what the current actual child care expenses were, does she?
She does not deny that he tried to reach out to her. So
why wouldn't it be fair to retroactively change child care contribution to that date?
Because father did not really reach out to mother to find out what these expenses actually were until late 2017 and just prior to starting these motion proceedings. As soon as father started asking mother questions and pressuring mother, mother clearly articulated in her affidavit that she was not comfortable discussing these issues with father because he tend to bully her.
Why didn't she just tell him in an email? Here's what the actual child care expenses. Why do things always have to be so difficult? And now we're at the Court of Appeals.
Certainly. She retained an attorney. She retained me to address these issues, going directly to his attorney, because by that point, father had retained his own counsel, and counsel was pressuring. Mother also cooperated with the child support worker, who did reach out to her asking whether she still incurred expenses, not necessarily requesting an explanation.
So he didn't ask the right question. The child care worker didn't ask her the right question. How much are you incurring?
Not necessarily. I believe that there is a specific process that Support and Collections has established with regards to these types of questions. So child care can be verified by county if the order is set according to PICS, and then there's a specific amount based on this PICS number included in the order. If that's no longer accurate, so what happens, Child Support and Collections will send out an inquiry to the parent asking, are these still the expenses that you incur? And then the parent will respond saying yes or no. And if a modification is needed, then Support and Collections refers it back to the court. It's not up to Support and Collections without a court order to modify.
Ms. Jensen, what's troubling me is that you're making this argument as if you're asking us to review the child support magistrate's decision. And what's troubling is that there's at least some indication the district court, who's supposed to be doing that independent review, was using the wrong standard. So could you focus on that? Because do we even get to, if we believe the district court reviewed this using the wrong standard, do we even get to these underlying issues, or do we need to just remand to the district court to undertake that independent evaluation?
I don't believe that the court used the wrong standard. Even though the court articulated perhaps an incorrect standard, there is plenty of evidence in the record to support that the court applied the right standard. So the court says, I'm going to do this. That is not necessarily correct, but then does the right thing. And the reason why I say that, if the court looks at District Court's September 18th record, paragraph 8 states, based upon an independent review of the record, the court finds finding of fact, inclusion of law, and order were factually accurate and consistent with Minnesota law. In other portions of the order, the court notes that the record was reviewed, affidavits were reviewed, transcript was reviewed, law was reviewed, and the child support magistrate did not abuse her discretion. She properly issued this decision stating that under the circumstances as presented to the court, this was an appropriate, not permitting or not modifying retroactively child care support obligations of father was appropriate. If I can also direct your honors to Minnesota Rules of General Practice, Rule 377.09, Subdivision 2B, I want to point out that part of the language that Mr. Bruder had an issue with that was included in District Court's second order denying the request for reconsideration is right out of the rule. The court said in its order, and the rule states under Subdivision 2B, the child support magistrate or district court judge shall make an independent review of any findings or other provisions of the underlying decision and order for which specific changes are requested. I want to direct you to Subdivision 3, Record on Review. The review by child support magistrate of district court judge shall be based upon the decision of the child support magistrate or district court judge and exhibits and affidavits filed, and where a transcript has not been filed, may be based upon audio recordings. The transcript has been filed. The court did review the transcript.
So let me see if I've got your position correct. You would agree that the standard set forth in, I think it is the second sentence of that original order denying the motion for review, that the court determines that the findings and order are not supported by the record or the decision is contrary to law is not the right standard, but that the court also addressed the right standard and, from your perspective, applied the right standard. Am I capturing it
That
correctly.
Is correct, absolutely. And not only that, but we have a situation where two different judicial officers on three separate occasions reviewed the facts, applied the law, and determined that a retroactive modification was absolutely not appropriate, especially back to 2011, which was the date of the stipulation that the parties reached.
So if we can go back to that, if there is undisputed evidence that later, I don't know at what point you would say it's undisputed, is it 2016 or 17 that we talked about when, based on, what is it, tax returns, it's clear that less than $800 was being incurred. Tell me if that's, is there any disputed evidence that at some point the child care expense decreased?
There is not a set time frame of when the child support or child care expense decreased. The tax returns are troublesome because, as your honors may know, the IRS only permits to write off a certain level of child care expenses. And practically speaking, once a person reaches that level, you stop tracking your records. There's also the issue that not all three children were claimed on taxes, and therefore not all three child care.
Why shouldn't this be a question that should have actually been explored? I mean, it's going forward, there's a reduction to actual costs incurred, right? I mean,
absolutely.
So
yes.
Then the question, and at the start of it, the costs exceeded the amount that they actually agreed to, they deviated downward from the PICs, right?
Correct.
Okay. At some point in that time period, apparently costs decreased, and you're saying, but the record isn't clear about that.
That's correct.
But it doesn't also seem to be your point that the agreement, unless it is your point, but that you discard on a going forward basis, that the $800 applied irrespective of whether any costs were incurred or not. I mean, is it your position that $800 agreement continued indefinitely, even if there was a decrease to zero of child care expenses?
Absolutely. That is our position. And the reason that is our position is because at the time this agreement was reached, Mr. Foss received a substantial benefit. He received about a 25% reduction in his obligation. The parties at that point agreed that regardless of what actual child care expenses were, moving forward, his child care support obligation was going to be $800 a month. And it should have been his responsibility to monitor what was happening and if he was no longer satisfied with that, seek modification, which he did in 2018.
How would he monitor it?
Your Honor, and actually it goes to what Mr. Bruder was discussing in that Mr. Foss was legally precluded from having access to this information. That is absolutely not accurate. Child care is much like education. Father absolutely had a right to receive information about the children's child care expenses, their attendance records. He also
had... But what law do we look at to see that that's the case? Is it part of an appendix attached to the court's order?
Absolutely.
It says child care expenses.
It does not explicitly say child care expenses, but it includes information about the children, and that would be the type of information that I would...
So you're telling us something entirely contrary, that the appellant could have just contacted the child care provider based on the order and gotten the information.
Absolutely. Appellant is a joint legal custodian. None of his rights have been removed
by... But let me just ask you, if the order doesn't specifically say child care expenses, and I think you just said it doesn't,
right?
Then you're suggesting to us that all child care providers will read that appendix to the order and say, oh, in my infinite wisdom, this includes child care expenses. I must provide the information to the requester.
It is my position. And the reason why I say that is because we are not talking about a father who has been absent and just, you know, some man that calls a child care provider asking for information about these children that have never had contact.
But now you're suggesting that the child care provider will evaluate the worth of the father who is requesting the information and decide he's a good father, he's active, I should provide the information, even though the order doesn't tell me I must.
Not necessarily. This father was involved in these children's childcare. He routinely picked them up. He had a relationship established with childcare providers. There was no evidence that father submitted to this court to say that on April 5th of 2016, I tried to get this information, and I was greeted with a childcare provider who was hostile and told me, absolutely not. I know your guys' divorce situation. There is not a court order that explicitly orders me to do okay, so.
But that's different than what you're telling, what I think you just said. And that is that under the law, father could have sought this information from the child care provider, and the child care provider was required under the law to give it to father. Is that your position?
That is my position because I believe that child care is akin to education, and father is granted specific access to education records. So if the children are in preschool, that's an education facility. It is a licensed facility.
Well, let's just assume for a moment that you're not correct, that had he sought the information, the provider might have said properly, I'm sorry, you're a very nice man. I know you love your children, but we have to observe protocol. And this contract is with your ex, with the children's mother. I can't give you the information. I'm sure she will.
Certainly.
Okay, so what if that information wasn't directly obtainable by father? What else do you mean by it was father's responsibility to monitor?
Father, at that point, could have reached out to mother, could have reached out to his child support services worker to say, I believe that there was a reduction.
But doesn't the record tell us that when he did that, she would not give him the information? I'm not talking about whether it's right or wrong to go back to 2011. I'm just talking about the argument you're making about that it's his obligation to monitor it and how that might occur.
Your Honor, these facts were not an issue. There was no facts in the record to support that mother was completely non-responsive to father. What mother's affidavit stated is that when father reached out to me, I was afraid to work with him because he typically bullied me. I hired an attorney, and then my attorney communicated with his attorney. That's consistent with the record. So it wasn't, again, I go back to, if we're looking back at 2017, then perhaps it is a little bit murkier. But father doesn't get to sit back and say, I will now decide that this retroactive modification will go back to 2011. I'm no longer in agreement with the agreement that I originally reached that really greatly benefited me for years. And now I want to go back and recalculate to see at what point it was no longer beneficial.
Right. And we don't actually know how long it benefited him because that's not in the record, right?
It's not
when you
say
for years it benefited him. There's an absence of information of the actual costs and what they were over time. I mean, that's fair to say, right?
To an extent it is, Your Honors. And I see that I'm out of time, but if I may briefly respond to this issue, it's part of the concern here is that if we go back and look at this retroactively, the statute only allows to go back and modify this when there was a reduction in the amount. So then if we accept that this $800 was appropriate at the 2011 level, disregarding the fact that there was a significant benefit to father, and then we'll move along this timeline to figure out at what point it was no longer beneficial to him, and then penalize mom for dad's lack of taking any action sooner, that's going to result in great injustice. It is our position that the court did exactly what it should have done. The court did not abuse its discretion. Two judicial officers exercised their discretion properly in denying father's motion, and for that reason, it needs to be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
Yes, but first I have to figure out how to lower the podium.
There's a toggle switch. Do you see it? It looks like a.
Got it.
Go.
While you're doing that, are you Ms. Altman?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to briefly touch on a few points. Respondent's counsel suggested that the child support magistrate properly exercised the discretion allotted to her under Section 518A.39 based on the circumstances presented to her at the time. That, I guess, opens the door to this comment. She also refused to hear any testimony that was proffered from my client, which might have changed the circumstances presented to her, even though Rule 364 explicitly allows the presentation of such testimony at the hearing.
But why should we look at that? I mean, I understand it, you didn't raise that objection when you asked for the review by the district judge.
I did indicate, did I specifically say no testimony was presented? No, I didn't, because I wasn't at that hearing. I represented Mr. Foss only at the point that he decided to ask for district court review. It was only when I actually saw the transcript that I realized exactly what had happened in terms of the child support magistrate refusing to allow any testimony at all. But in the motion for review, I did indicate that the child support magistrate improperly denied him retroactive modification of his child support obligation. And one of the vehicles to reach that conclusion is her refusal to allow any testimony to supplement the record. That's the best explanation I can provide the court as to how that happened. With regard to the notion that this $800, that there was some sort of an agreement that this $800 monthly child care support obligation would extend indefinitely, that argument, I admit, was made by the respondent before the child support magistrate. She rejected that argument, and for good reason. First of all, there's nothing in the record to suggest that that was ever the party's agreement. Second, it wouldn't really be allowed because it's contrary to the statute. Third, it would be nonsensical for Mr. Foss to have bargained for a modest reduction in his child care contribution, to have bargained away to the statutory right to modify that away. And for those reasons, the child support magistrate on that issue was clearly correct and appropriate in the way she approached it. With respect to the argument that Mr. Foss had some duty that he didn't exercise to monitor the child care costs and to take appropriate action. Your Honor, first of all, there is simply no legal support for the notion that every child care operator in Minnesota, by virtue of the fact that there's a child care support obligation, is legally obligated to share records with the parent that they don't contract with. That is a private contractual arrangement. And that child care operator is entirely within their rights in saying, my contract is with the respondent, and you're going to have to get the records from her. I don't have any obligation to provide them
but
to you.
But father would know where the child, or could know, where the child is attending. Child care, how, what days, what hour, you know, all of the things around that, right? He has a right to that. So if it reduced substantially, I'm assuming that there was less presence at the child in child care.
I can't honestly say whether my client ever picked up the children at child care. I don't think he did, but I'm just not sure about that. But even if he did, he clearly indicated that by the time the children were in school, he suspected the expenses were a lot lower. And what he did is what we would encourage all of our clients to do. He directly approached the respondent and asked for the information. She stonewalled him. She stonewalled the child care worker. And based on that, it's my position that retroactive modification, at least for a period of time, should have been explored by the court and would have been appropriate. And I have 34 seconds left. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. We are in recess to consider our non-oral calendar. Thank you.